This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Jay Hanselman filling in today for Dan Hurley. Cincinnati City Council passes an operating budget for the new fiscal year that starts Sunday, and Mayor Cranley vetoes a plan to move a bus shelter downtown that could lessen track blockages for the streetcar. Joining me to talk about this week's stories at Cincinnati City Hall are WCPO digital reporter Paula Christian, Cincinnati Enquirer City Hall reporter Sharon Coolidge, also known as Sherry Coolidge. Sorry, I can't break
That's
that
fine.
Habit. And Cincinnati Business Courier staff reporter and columnist Chris Wetterich. Later in the hour, we'll talk about the turbulent times for some major companies headquartered in Cincinnati. You can join the conversation. Our phone number is 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Again, 513-419-7100. What's our City Hall bunch? Of City Hall, it would feel more like home.
We could have done that for sure. A
little comedy hour, too, between all of us.
Some of that may not be appropriate, though, for air.
Truth.
Well, we have a budget now, and we'll dig into the details. But to start off, I just want you each to just give me your thoughts on, you know, the budget process and what do you make of the plan that council approved. And Sherry, I'll let you go first.
I think, you know, it was a shortened time period this year, and I was really worried. There were a lot of extra council meetings were scheduled, and, I really thought we might need them. Like, is this the process that usually takes, like, a month and a half? They squeezed it in about 2 weeks.
And we should say the process was shortened because the city manager changed right before the budget was supposed to be released.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and, you know, he's in charge of that, so.
I agree with one of the items you tweeted out about how this budgets, the discussions at least seem to be a little more public this year than in years past, where it just seemed like the decisions were made behind closed doors and then they just plop it down. I mean, at times it seemed long, but it was really nice to hear some like back and forth discussion on what do you think? What do you think? What will you go for? I liked that.
Chris?
I just think that it was the first in a multiple years long reckoning. Over the city's finances, there was a lot of tax and fee increases. There was $10 million in cuts. And I think you're going to continue to see that because the city is spending more money than it brings in. The last two fiscal years were not structurally balanced. The budget office admitted that at the beginning of the process. And I kind of doubt that this one will be balanced as well. So we're going to see, I think, some more debates. We're going to have a tax increase on the ballot this fall for the emissions tax. And, I think you're going to continue to see much of the same for the next several years.
We'll delve into a couple of those things you mentioned, though. Does part of this make the city like the little boy who cried wolf? Every year we get this gloom and doom that there's a – and this one just kept getting worse. It started out, I want to say, a $20 million deficit, and then it was $25 million. And then at one point it was 29 to, I think, $36 million, and the deficit ended up being $32 million. But again, for the most part, for what people see as far as layoffs, no layoffs, just a series of cuts and some fee increases, and we've closed that $32 million gap.
I think that the rabbits, we talk over there about, they seem to always pull a rabbit out of their hat. Well, the rabbits that they're pulling out of their hat now is not hidden money. It's not money that they've got in different accounts that they move along or move around. They're actually starting to increase taxes. And in this case, they created a new tax for billboards this year, which they're going to probably get sued over. And they also are going to send an admissions tax to the voters. And I think that you're going to see some more talk about increasing the earnings tax in the coming years. And this parking tax that they discussed, I think that is not going to go away either. So the rabbits that they're pulling out of their hat are different from what we saw maybe 2 or 3 years ago. Their revenue increases. They're not, we found this money here or there. They still have some of those things in this budget, but not as much as the kind of things they used to be doing a couple years ago.
Well, Jay, this is actually gets to something that we, have been talking about, which is, everyone says like it has seemed fine. There's no layoffs. We get to it and everything is great. But this is the year where we started to see all of the problems with these budgets where we're just, you know, doing everything we can with a Band-Aid to put over it. We have a troubled 911 center, which we've known for a long time, but now here we're really seeing it with Kyle Plush, and it needed 11 new employees. You know, public services, they were talking about brownouts with the garbage. We need at least 10 new sanitation collectors. But, you know, at the end of last year's budget and the year before and the year before, everybody is saying things are fine. There's troubles over in the health department. You know, a group of employees wrote a letter about what's going on over there, talking about the home nursing program. And so all of these cuts that we have seen, it's like, it's almost like we've been giving it lip service because it really is leading to some troubles.
And I think all of the department heads, when they came in to speak, talked about that, how you can't cut us anymore. We can't do this job with what you're asking us to do. And I do think the sanitation workers, when the new, brand new head of Department of Public Services came in and is talking about how sanitation workers are having to pick up extra hours every single day and how overworked they are and how understaffed they are, that was dramatic. And, you know, the other problem is we have a tremendous backlog on capital maintenance in this city that does not get much attention, and it should. And it's really just a matter of time before we do have a big accident at, for example, the fleet maintenance garage that was built in the 1930s that they're worried about the floor caving in. There's no talk about fixing that, and there's no money in the budget, and that's tens of millions of dollars.
The squeakiest wheel, you know, gets the money.
The acting city manager and the mayor both pointed out that, you know, they closed this $32 million deficit with no layoffs and no cuts to basic services. But that's kind of hard to believe. I mean, there were $10 million worth of cuts. Now, they may not be visible things, but besides police and fire, departments are doing more with much, much less than they were a decade ago.
Or the money is being moved from other places. They increased the stormwater fees for the second time in 12 months. They moved a bunch of services that were under the general fund into the stormwater fund. This is the money that ratepayers pay for their water to leave their house, or the water to leave their, you know, their toilet, whatever it is. So they've moved those expenses around and increased revenue from it. So they've got all these taxes and fees that they have raised. And you know, that's how they're
right.
Making
stormwater
ends meet.
Rates are going to double over a series of
it's a
years.
Huge increase.
And you know that comes on your bill every month.
Yeah,
let's talk about the fee increases. We mentioned the stormwater fee, parking meter rates increased. But not only did the rates increase, but the hours are also extended in some areas now. So you're going to have to put money in the meters longer into the evening. And I think that was particularly true for
11 o'clock and over the Rhine.
Over the Rhine, which I think they call south.
Yeah, three days.
Yeah, on Thursday, Friday, Saturday.
There was a higher fee for
commercial waste.
For commercial waste. Chris can talk about that. First, basically, if you live in a single family resident, the city picks your garbage up. But if you live in a condo, a multifamily.
Above four units.
Or a commercial, like a business, you have to pay a private contractor to do your waste collection.
We're double taxed, basically. We're paying the same taxes that a single family homeowner is paying. But if we live in a multiple, in any building over four units, we have to privately contract to have our garbage removed. So it's a double tax on people. They increase that tax, or they increase that by, I think, 10%.
Yeah, from 10 to 20. It's like 20% of whatever the hauler is making off of the collection.
Was that just introduced last year or the year before last? It's relatively new, I think.
I don't recall, but it was interesting because liberals on the council proposed increasing it even more, and they were shot down. That was Councilman Landsman and Councilwoman Denard. They were kind of shot down over that.
Had to find the money for the health gap.
we haven't even gotten to that.
Hang on, we'll get there. Sherry, I think one you found, and I knew about it, but there's now a developer tax. What's the developer tax? Well, one of the fees that increased, there's like a fee that developers have to pay?
I think that's just the building permit.
Yeah, that's building permits because that's the one they pay. There's two different kinds of building permits.
Right.
Like if you're a homeowner and you want to put in a pool or a deck, you have to go down and get a permit. Those went up. And if you're a developer and you want to build, those went up. The developers will notice it because it's like last year was less expensive. But I think the average homeowner won't know what it cost to put in a pool the year before.
Right.
They're doing it this year.
Right.
And did we miss it? I know we talked about the parking meter rates, building permits.
Billboard fee.
Billboard fee.
Parking rates are set to bring in $2.5 million more.
They're doubling. It's the amount of revenue they're going to bring in from parking meters is increasing by more than 100%.
Yeah, it's.
But they did veto the parking boot again this year for the second year in a row, which would have brought in $400,000. And it's purely of the optics of it that they don't like it.
I honestly have not figured out what I mean. And I know they think this is an equity thing, but if your car has been towed because you haven't paid your tickets, would you rather deal with that or would you rather call somebody and then you pay the fine and they come down and they take the boot off your car?
I don't think they're towing cars.
Well, I don't know what they are and aren't doing, but yeah.
You know, another thing.
But you would think, though, in that situation, wouldn't you want the city to collect the money that is owed it? And these are not people that just have one-time parking tickets.
No, these are three or more tickets.
That's important to note. It wasn't that they were going to get money from the boots themselves. That was all going to go to a private contractor, which sound familiar to me from 2013's parking plan. But they were going to get the increased revenue from people paying the fines to get the boots off their car.
Which they owe. These are fines they owe anyways. So it's just the city getting their money back. But then why would they want to do that?
And we'll save the health gap until after our first break here. But the general fund budget comes out to, I think it's about $407 million. Council ended up making approximately, if my math was right, about $2.8 million worth of changes to the capital budget. But that's such a small percentage of the overall budget. But that's what takes the most time and debate about that $2.8 million.
Yeah, I mean, that's the way it is every year. It's always a fight over the last couple million dollars. In this case, they added some interesting things back to it. They put in a red bike expansion. This is the bike sharing service. They're going to add e-bikes, which are electric powered bikes that could, you know, traverse our hills a little bit better, which I think is a really interesting idea. And they're going to expand Red Bike to Bond Hill and I believe Lower Price Hill. And that's one of the major things I think that they did.
And the Central Parkway bike lane expansion.
That is just crazy because
at $125,000.
Well, it's also not going to happen until 2022 is the earliest it could happen.
And I think the $125,000 they put in, that is for a match for a grant that they're hoping to get.
That they don't have yet.
That they don't have. They just applied for it. Matter of fact, they had to fight to apply for that grant, and so they don't even know that they're going to win the grant yet.
The mayor is a vehement opponent of that bike lane.
Do you think he wrote a letter to the grant people?
I think he might have left that to somebody else. In fact, if they want to get the grant, they probably shouldn't have let him write the letter.
This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Jay Hanselman filling in today for Dan Hurley. It's our weekly news review. Joining me today are WCPO digital reporter Paula Christian, Cincinnati Enquirer City Hall reporter Sharon Coolidge, and Cincinnati Business Courier staff reporter and columnist Chris Wetterich. You can join the conversation. Our phone number is 513-419-7100 or email talk at wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Again, 513-419-7100. So as promised, let's talk about the Center for Closing the Health Gap. In times past, a couple of years ago, their funding was $1 million for the city. The current fiscal year, it was $750,000. I believe Acting City Manager Patrick Dehaney proposed $562,000. Mayor John Cranley proposed zero, and City Council this week set on $550,000. And I got the sense that some thought this may be the year that the health gap would not be funded.
I asked Kevin Flynn before this process, I said, so what do you think? What do you think they're going to get this year? And he said, probably somewhere around $500,000.
He was only off by $50,000.
Yeah.
The mayor would tell you that it wasn't that he zeroed it out. It was that he said they could go and apply for human services funding like everybody else. And that's kind of been the position that a lot of people have had. If they're so great, if they're doing their job well, that they can compete with the other human services providers to provide that money. The two people who really wanted the health gap in the budget were Tamiya Denard and Greg Landsman. And their argument was that historically Cincinnati has had some terrible disparities in health between blacks and whites. Councilman Landsman brought up that the average lifespan for an African American is 10 years less than whites, and that's why the health gap needed to be funded.
The counter to that, though, which you know, we can't ask questions during council meetings, is they've gotten millions of dollars over the years. And not even just that 1 million, it's climbed, they got 250.
It's been almost $5 million over the past decade that they will have collected from the city.
And there's still the same disparity. So it's like, it's hard to reconcile, like, is it working?
Yes. And the contract, the performance metrics on the contract, I mean, they are, even this former city manager, Harry Black, said these performance metrics are sort of soft goals. They're not hard and fast goals. If you don't meet a performance metric, you don't lose funding, as we've seen year after year with the health gap. I mean, for example, they're supposed to have 14 healthy corner stores where you can get fruits and vegetables. Last year when we visited, we found 4. This year when we visited, we found 5. But their contract is the same, and they still keep getting funding.
And I think there's some who have argued the most of the human services groups go through the United Way process that manages the application process and scoring the applications. And some of them have complained it's harder for us to compete for $30,000, mm-hmm. and these same metrics don't apply to an organization that's getting $500,000.
So, I mean, and the other So they didn't have to go through that process. They were supposed to go through a different process. The city, in its operating budget, funds a data analytics unit where they're, you know, work on, you know, best practices and look at outcomes of everything. I mean, at the 911 center, when we started really talking about that, you can go back every month and look at all of the issues, because that's what that center does. And it's expensive to have that, but they say it saves money. Well, they put in all these, some of these outside groups, and the health gap did not go. And so, and then they came into council and they said, we gave our outcomes to the city manager's office. I have a public records request in. The first answer was, what are you talking about? I don't know. And the second answer is, I'll see. And now that was Monday. I have nothing.
The performance metric she's talking about is simply the contract that they wrote themselves.
Chris, I'll let you start this. The interesting thing is the mayor's flip on this, because when he got elected in 2014, I think, there was even money that was taken away from the health department and directed toward the health gap.
Yeah.
And we should say that the mayor vetoed the ordinance that contained funding for the health gap. Council was able to override it. So there's
the six Democrats overrided it. It's important to note who it was.
They're going to get their funding. But his comment was the health department could spend this $550,000 better than the health gap.
Yeah, it is interesting, and it's worth reminding people of the politics of this, right? So the health gap, the Center for Closing the Health Gap, is headed by Dwight Tillery, the former mayor. He was a big ally of Mayor Cranley during the 2013 mayoral election. He co-chaired the campaign. They were pals for a couple of years there, and then they had a major, major falling out over the health department. There was a person that Mayor Tillery wanted to have in there as
former Mayor Tillery
as the head of the health department, and you know, Mayor Cranley was not willing to stand in the way of that. He was okay with Odell Owens competing for that job, and Tillery didn't like that. So they had a major falling out, and Tillery endorsed and worked on behalf of Yvette Simpson during the 2017 mayoral election. After the election, the budget comes out. You know, the mayor has zeroed out direct funding for the health gap. So it's worth noting all of that, I think.
Sure. I think you and I talked about this at City Hall. What happened to the capital acceleration plan that was much cheerleaded a couple of years ago in this budget?
Yeah, we didn't talk about that. Don't ask me that question. Actually, that's on my list of things to check. Because, you know, they did talk about
taking... It's a shell. It's not near what was proposed a couple of years
ago. They took all the money out of, like...
Did they? Or they put it back in? Because when they were talking about it, Patrick Duhaney is like, we're not touching that money. But the one budget had called for it, and I don't know whatever happened with that. But it is important to note that the city, under Harry Black, borrowed $100 million to fix the roads and the fleet.
New fleet.
And keeping track of that program, I'm not sure it's as
My understanding
robust.
Was they kept the fleet intact, but they took money from things like street calming and street sidewalk repairs and things like that, and they shifted it over to give more money, $450,000, to recreation centers, which desperately need capital improvements too, and deferred park maintenance. I mean, the list of capital needs in this city is extraordinary.
I think it's over $100 million.
It's extraordinary.
And that may be conservative.
I don't think they took – I mean, I wouldn't say they took all of it. I think they took a little chunk of it. I mean, to put $450 into the rec centers was not a very big dent in that, nor was what they gave the park system from that pot of money as well.
Let's talk a little bit longer term. We're talking about kicking the can down the road. And if you have a pop can that you're kicking down the road, you can keep kicking it and kicking it. It's going to dent up and it's going to get pretty damaged. How long can this process of just kicking the can down the road continue for the city budget until you have no can?
Well, you should answer that. You've been here longer than us.
You know, it'll be interesting to see. Like, I mean, this next election, really, it'll be a big shift. There'll be a new mayor. There will be six new council members, and they might have different priorities and cut different things. And, you know, this council has been adamant they wanted to keep the Environmental Services Department. Under Harry Black, many of these council members created all these data analytics and, like, this whole thing at Centennial One to really, like, these best business practices, and redid the Permit Center. And so maybe we'll see some shifts in spending.
You know, I think it was interesting that it was the council members who led the charge to increase some of the – or create this billboard tax and increase the admissions tax this fall. Normally you'd expect – I would expect a mayor to leave a tax increase, and council members typically don't have the political courage to do so, but they are doing it in this case. So I think that you're going to – see people continue not to want to cut things in this budget or in these budgets, and I think they're going to continue to try to raise revenue. It's important to back up, though, and remind people that there's a couple of contributing factors to why this was such a problematic budget and we continue to have these issues. Is the state made cuts to the local government fund and the estate tax, which deprive the city of tens of millions of revenue every single year. And then the mayor also gave out some raises in the year before the election that increased the cost of the city for all unionized workers.
And let's not let everybody off the hook, because city council themselves has continued to
totally approve those. Yes.
Well, but they approved the raises. But council has also had the policy since 2001 of rolling back the property tax millage, which has also cost, at the last count, I think it was $50+ million.
They all wear the jacket for that. And the mayor loves that policy.
And our earnings taxes have been way below projection over for the last couple of years, which each year they form a budget based on these sort of idealistic earnings taxes that you see forecasts, and each year they come in short.
It's important to remind people, too, that the earnings tax here is 2.1%, and Columbus and Cleveland is 2.5%, and 0.3% of ours goes to transit, which is unlike the other two cities. So in reality, our earnings tax going to the city's general fund is 1.8%.
Let me quickly roll a couple of email questions here together. When we're talking about financial problems, someone wants to know, if they have all the money problems, where are they getting the money to help FC Cincinnati build a new soccer stadium?
Oh, I forgot about that one. That was another thing they did, was spend down the rainy day fund that they had put together from the Blue Ash Airport money. They spent that on FC Cincinnati. So that was another hit before they even started to write this budget.
I'll roll a couple of questions here together about tax abatements and Kroger this week getting job creation tax credits to relocate some technology jobs to downtown Cincinnati. The question is it time to rethink? Do you need to keep offering abatements for people to move to downtown and over the Rhine?
Well, there's a couple lines of – I mean, it probably depends a lot on your politics how you answer that. I mean, if people want our earnings tax profits to come in higher, then you have to have good-paying jobs to be able to do that. But there's a converse argument as well. If these companies are coming anyways, do they really need tax abatements?
I mean, it probably definitely needs like some sort of like good hard look. We've written about it, and every, you know, couple years they say they're going to. But like when you're talking about downtown and giving abatements, some of that money goes to the streetcar, and that they need that program, the VTICA program. And so those abatements actually are.
Let's do a quick round robin here, because we've got a couple of things we've got to talk about before we run out of time. Councilmember Amy Murray attended a conference in Nashville last week about 911 technology and emergency dispatch technology. And, of course, this all relates to the death of Kyle Plush. She did indicate that the city is also going to have a smart 911 system similar to what the county has now, where you can, you know, basically create an account, provide additional information that 911 can use to, you know, help them help you in an emergency. The Plush family this week was at the hearing or the Law and Public Safety meeting on Monday, but they didn't speak. But Sherry, we talked about this. They sent out a statement afterwards, basically reiterating the call for change.
They did. You know, they had been speaking, and the last time they gave a presentation, like with a PowerPoint and everything. And this time, you know, they're just trying to keep the pressure on. I think this is going to be their mission, and I don't think that it's going to go away anytime soon. There are changes. Did we have a 911 update on Wednesday? Because we're supposed to get one every week.
I think they skipped it this week.
But there are a lot of things in the works over
there. What do you make of the – yesterday, I think we got a statement from the FOP where they had taken a vote supporting Captain James Gramke, who was removed from leadership of the 911 center.
Well, I know for sure behind the scenes that people are upset. If you look at all the changes we've had at the 911 center over the years, the civilian didn't work. We put it back under police control. These were always very big discussions. Are we going to do this? What's happening? And in this case, they arbitrarily one day at 11 o'clock a.m. put the 911 center without telling anyone back under civilian control. And they were kind of like, well, maybe temporary. We don't know. And it seems like it's permanent.
Chris, you had a story yesterday that Assistant City Manager John Jewick might be a little bit more careful about what he says at cocktail parties.
You know, I think John's going to get a bad rap for that story, but and he probably shouldn't. Basically, the thing about 4th and Race, right?
Which is a long stalled development.
It was announced in 2013. There was a groundbreaking in 2016. It's a vacant lot today, so nothing has been going on there. Basically. You know, he said to a leading critic of the city and 3CDC's attempts to build something there, he basically said the project was dead. And word got back to the developer, Flaherty and Collins in Indianapolis, and they were immediately on the phone with the city and 3CDC and trying to work something out. The city issued a statement yesterday saying, you know, we think 3CDC and Flaherty have worked this out, and we're going to bring some ordinances to the council in the next few weeks to modify this deal yet again. It would be the third modification of the development deal.
Don't mind me if I say I've heard that before.
Exactly. I will believe it when I see, you know, bricks and mortar and whatnot going up there.
I'll let whoever wants to talk about this one. Even moving a bus shelter to benefit the streetcar brings a mayoral veto. Of course, part of that could be the price tag. I think Paula sent out the tweet of $600,000.
$600,000! It was like reverberated throughout council.
So basically, this is a bus shelter on Main Street near the federal building that kind of basically you have buses and streetcars trying to interact with each other, and they're not doing it well, so they want to move the bus shelter like a block or block and a half north.
But it's the cost involved in possibly having to move utility lines and digging up concrete. And
that's where the 600 comes from.
And
really, oh, go ahead. Sorry.
Well, I mean, and Greg Landsman saying it's not really going to cost $600,000. But if they can spend up to $600,000, you know, why is that number being thrown out unless that's a possibility?
It probably was a memo that could have been better written to have like a range, like 100,000 up to 600,000.
Yeah.
I'll admit that was my first thought when I saw $600,000 to move a bus stop.
One block.
This is the city shooting a bazooka at its foot once again when it comes to the streetcar. I mean, it's not even a gun anymore. It's a bazooka.
But it came out after all of that. It was, you know, an entertaining fight, and we all knew it probably really wouldn't cost $650,000. But, like, after that, the bus riders who actually use it are like, yeah, we don't need to stop there.
They don't need to stop there. They could integrate that stop into a bunch of other bus stops. You know, a million people have posted on Twitter how it could be done. It is ridiculous. It's ridiculous to veto the thing. It's ridiculous that there should even be a fight about this.
But the nice thing about it is it was vetoed in June, and the way council rules, you can't override a veto until the next regularly scheduled meeting, which will be August 1st. So we'll get to talk about it more in August.
We're blowing away another month of streetcar service over a stupid fight.
Just quickly, council is going to be on break. Do we have any sense of if Patrick Duhaney is going to become the permanent city manager, or do we have, has anyone heard anything at all about the process of either trying to select somebody to take
question.
His place
or I haven't asked.
Take acting off of his title?
Well, not that I can say here.
They have talked at the, I mean, they said that they were going to do a national search. You know, P.G. Sittenfeld and David Mann are kind of adamant about that. But they did say that we needed to get through the budget process. So that's kind of where we're,
now
I mean,
we're
they
it.
Said we were going to do that.
And you have to wonder if anyone outside is going to be interested nationally coming in here for a job that they may not have for about two and a half years, because when a new mayor is elected, they likely will want to pick their own city manager.
I spoke to the head of ICMA, the City Managers Association, about this months ago, and he said, yeah, Cincinnati is a city. That's a job that people would want because it's a good-sized city, but this is going – the whole problem with the city manager is going to kind of be a red flag for candidates from outside.
We have been talking about another busy week at Cincinnati City Hall. My guests were WCPO digital reporter Paula Christian, Cincinnati Enquirer City Hall reporter Sharon Coolidge, and Cincinnati Business Courier staff reporter and columnist Chris Wetterich. Thank you all for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
This is 91.7 WVXU Cincinnati Edition. I'm Jay Hanselman filling in for Dan Hurley. It's our Friday news review. Kroger is moving some technology jobs to downtown Cincinnati and announced a new joint venture with a British online grocer. General Electric announced a split, and that could have local impacts, and Fifth Third says it's cutting jobs. Joining me to talk about some of this week's business headlines are Cincinnati Enquirer business reporter Alex Coolidge and WCPO digital reporter Dan Monk. You can join our conversation. The number is 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Again, 513-419-7100. Guys, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Alex, let me start with you with something that we learned yesterday, that Convergys, based in downtown Cincinnati, is being acquired. So tell us about that sale.
Well, it's being bought out by a technological peer based out of Fremont, California, I believe. It's a, $2.8 billion cash and stock deal. It's kind of not super surprising because the CEO, 5 years, sort of announced early this
January.
Year, yeah. January-ish, that she was planning to hang it up, and it came after a few years of sort of muddled financial performance, and there was just a ton of industry speculation that, you know, this could be a little pickup for a larger company to come in and consolidate it, tuck it into its operations, which is what's going on right now.
Dan, does Cincinnati need to be worried about sometimes when companies are acquired, if they have a big footprint, as Convergys does downtown, is this concerning?
It's 1,000 local jobs. I mean, that's what Convergys employs here locally. In the past, they've been as high as maybe 1,300, 1,400.
Did they ever get as high as they had promised when they got tax abatements to keep their facility downtown?
I don't think they ever did. They bought a building, the Atrium. I think it was the Atrium 1 building downtown. They promised 1,450 jobs, ended up paying a clawback. They paid back some of the tax incentives they got for that deal because they never reached that total. But they've had, you know, various call centers at various times all over town. So it's not a small employer, and it's possible that some of those jobs will be lost as a result of this merger because the headquarters is going to be in California. They said in a filing today that they have no plans to close the Cincinnati facility, but they didn't say how many people will work here.
We're concerned about whether the Convergys jobs that are downtown. We know that now that Kroger is going to be moving some digital jobs downtown. Alex, it sounds like it's a pretty large number of jobs.
Right now they're moving. They're just transferring 600 local jobs, but basically that unit is growing. They're predicting about 1,000 jobs. The six will become 1,000 in the next 3 years. And I mean, basically, Kroger has been just sprinting ahead on everything digital in the last year since Amazon took over Whole Foods and terrified, scared the heck out of just about every traditional supermarket peer. And they've They've pretty much topped out their click and collect expansion. About a third of their stores have that capability now. So there's a new push on home delivery, and they're still sort of they're not experimenting. They have they've expanded home delivery to a number of vendors to about, I want to say, about 45 markets nationwide, metro markets.
I think they say they can reach 75% of the households they serve with either click list or home delivery now.
And I think yesterday at their shareholders meeting, they actually rolled out or talked about the idea of delivery with a driverless.
I didn't see it roll.
Okay.
I don't know if it can roll.
You need to know this. There will be a notice if you click and buy something. They'll say, we're sending you an automated car. Right now, we don't know where they're going to test that. They're going to test the technology. It's nifty.
It is pretty cool.
Hopefully it won't. Yeah, hopefully it'll go smoothly and all that fun stuff.
And they assume consumer. I mean, personally, that to me seems like the dumbest idea.
Kind of off putting.
Maybe I'm just stupid. I don't mind going to the grocery store, but you may have a driverless car pull up to my house with my grocery order.
That's right. Well, they actually said. I mean, I was interviewing the co-founder of the company, Dave Ferguson. His name. The name of the company is Nuro. He said they actually have the capability for the once it pulls up to your house, the doors will open because they'll sense that your cell phone is within range. And when they tested that, they said people found that off-putting. They actually wanted to enter a PIN number or actually prompt the doors to open from their cell phone because they wanted to control. They didn't want somebody running off with their groceries, I guess. Yeah,
it's a. Actually, the other big technology thing that Kroger's also got in the wings is the Ocala partnership, which is a their.
Is that how you pronounce that?
You know, okay. I'm on the fly. Is it?
I mean, I don't know. I've come to think of Ocado, Okada.
Oh Ocala? Yeah, that's right. That's right. Right. It's a but anyway, it's a British pure play on home delivery. But what's really interesting about it is they have no physical stores in the UK, and what they're planning to do in the next few years is they've agreed, contracted with Kroger, they're going to set up fully automated warehouses. And you're going to be able to shop online and then – like a robotic warehouse is going to put together your order and it's going to show up at your door.
Have you seen the video of these things?
It will be nifty if it works, but
it's already working.
In the UK. It works in the UK, but rolling it out, it's
Dan, I think you wrote about
how widespread
that.
It is.
Your headline was, could this reshape the industry?
It could have a big impact, and it's going to be expensive. Some of the folks we talked to about what it takes to build this kind of a facility, it can cost up to $300 million per warehouse. And they're talking about building 20 of them over the next, 3 years, I think?
No, thereabouts.
Yeah. So it's not going to be a cheap venture for Kroger, but it is their entree to places like New York where they don't have stores. And it's a very dense market where, a lot of people already buy online. And if they can be... And plus, New York is one of the towns where they actually sell pretty well their Simple Truth product. So I wouldn't be surprised if that's the first market they try because it's a market they've wanted to be in for a long time. And I think this is an easy way in for them.
Yeah, by contrast, like your typical marketplace store, a physical store costs like about $20 million to build. So that's like 15 times the cost of one of those.
Yeah.
And they actually pulled their horns in a little bit on the traditional store rebuilding and renovations to emphasize the tech side of the business. So,
and we're going to talk about General Electric here in just a second. But part of the what we're going to talk about General Electric is investor Nathan Peltz. And Kroger's shareholders yesterday voted on something that indirectly or maybe directly relates to Nelson Peltz. Or someone like
Kroger. Else.
Oh, you're talking about the chairman.
Issue number three, which passed yesterday at the Kroger annual meeting, was a very innocuously worded or entitled titled provision. Basically, and it passed. It's a measure that basically says, "Hey," in the headline, you know, of the thing, we're gonna allow better access to proxy. So if an outside investor wants to nominate a board member, here are the new rules and parameters of all that to do it. The thing, though, is if you actually read the thing, it basically says, oh, you know, all you need to qualify is, you know, about $350 million worth of company stock, and you must hold it for 3 years prior to your nomination. So what that really is it's a protective measure. Nelson Peltz started angling for a board seat like within weeks after getting his stake at Procter. This is designed to block something like that. Procter actually passed a similar measure like this, and part of Peltz's campaign for the proxy was he was also pushing a repeal of the rule at Procter. And it passed. A lot of companies are doing this. This was just putting some rules in black and white, that sort of thing.
And Dan, Kroger shareholders also were deciding whether the CEO, Rodney McMullen, should remain chairman or replaced by an outsider, and they voted on that yesterday.
Right. He's going to keep both jobs. I mean, it wasn't even a close vote.
Were the reasons?
Stocks up.
Well, the reason for splitting the jobs is that they say it leads to more independence. Board should be the boss of the CEO, and when the chairman of the board is also the CEO, that means Rodney McMullen's his own boss. But it's hard to get that kind of a measure passed in any year, and it's even harder when the CEO is popular like McMullen is right now.
Well, Kroger, yesterday there was also some talk about they provided an update on their new store that they're going to open in downtown Cincinnati late next year.
Right. They're on the fourth floor already, from what I understand.
And they have 14 more floors to go, I think.
Well, I mean, the shell for the retail space is already there. So I think they're thinking they're going to open that by the end of 2019 and then the apartments to follow the next spring. So.
Right.
Any surprises in what they talked about yesterday that you didn't already know?
I can't think of one. Can you?
It was a fairly routine thing. I mean, it would have been a little more white knuckle had the stock still been down. They had a bad quarter two quarters ago, and then they had a really nice quarter most recently. So the stock is up double digits percentage-wise, and that takes a whole lot of pressure. The thing that was interesting about the ballot measure regarding the board access was they probably pulled the trigger on putting that extra safeguard when the stock was down. And that's when your activist investors swoop in. They're like, hey, your stock's down. We got some friendly advice for you.
Break up your company.
Yeah, like GE.
That's the perfect segue.
Ouch.
General Electric could be splitting in half. We've got the major jet engine facility in Evendale, the General Electric office as part of the Banks project. What does that split mean locally?
Well,
could it mean locally?
Since aviation is a keeper, as I understand it, I doubt that it means all that much for Cincinnati. I think they're not going to be as big as they thought they were going to be at the Banks. But yeah. I think in terms of total employment, their jet engine business is doing really well. So I doubt that they're going to be cutting jobs in Cincinnati as a result of this restructuring. And the last I saw, they were still above 1,400 jobs at the Banks. I mean, at one time, and I think the mayor still says this, that it's a 2,000-job project. I don't know if it'll ever get to 2,000, but they are at about 1,400 jobs at the Banks, and that's a big cluster of highly paid workers, and that's good for that part of town.
The only question mark over that is that that operation was set up to service a $120 billion company across multiple units, and it's now going to be about an $80 billion company. Mm-hmm. So they're whacking more than a third of the scope of the company.
But that was going to be one of five of those centers, right?
I mean, yeah, but that's worldwide. This is the only one in North America. So, I mean, it's we don't know. There's too many variables. So, but you know, GE Aviation is going to become even more important to a smaller General Electric, which is nothing but good news for Cincinnati. We just don't know. You know, this is yet another, you know, thing of uncertainty for the poor old Banks project on the riverfront. It really looked like they were going to just really turn a corner with this operations center, and then GE went into all this uncertainty.
What can Nelson Peltz, as a board member of GE, and now also a board member of P&G. Mm-hmm. So we see the split, what's happening to GE. What should we be watching for at P&G?
First of all, he has a – it's his co-founder of his hedge firm is actually on the board at GE. But, I mean, I think they probably talk to each other at the office back in New York and, you know, that sort of thing. It just goes to show you – the magnitude of the tools that can go on the table at Procter & Gamble if things don't improve. GE is splitting apart. I mean, and it's if you were to apply this to a Procter model, this would be like selling off the stalwart baby care unit with Pampers and then throwing Gillette in to boost. This is not, you know, oh, you know, we're going to sell this hairspray brand that, you know, isn't really. No, this is like GE Healthcare was Flannery's ticket to the corner office. He ran that whole division before he got the top job. It's a pillar of GE, and now it's going to be a separately run company in about, you know, 1.5, 2 years or something like that. The thinking behind it, it's very similar to what Cincinnati Bell did on a very smaller scale. Cincinnati Bell was mired in a whole bunch of debt. They had this really hot performing division, data storage. And then they said, you know what? If we spin off CyrusOne as a standalone entity, it's worth more as a standalone company than it is embedded with us. Plus, once the stock takes off from that individual company, we use all that money to pay down debt. Well, GE's kind of doing something like that.
Dan, I'll give you the last word on P&G because we're about to run out of time.
Oops.
Well, I don't think they have much longer to turn it around. You know, the longer it takes, the more influence Peltz has inside the boardroom and among P&G employees and shareholders.
And we started out talking about the convergence and the number of jobs that they have downtown. P&G's footprint downtown is huge.
Yes. Yeah, it's
and
a 10,000 employees
even to convergence.
10,000 employees, and it's the kind of jobs that you really can't replace. These are high paid people who are running huge companies.
These are not call center jobs.
Right.
You know, these are people running massive divisions. I mean, some of them are you want to minimize the impact locally. It's a little concerning.
And we have that to look forward to as we move forward.
It's going to be a hot summer.
We have been discussing some of this week's business headlines in Greater Cincinnati. My guests were Cincinnati Enquirer Business reporter Alex Coolidge and WCPO digital reporter Dan Monk. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show was Pete Reitmeier. Our assistant producer was Selena Reeder. Our intern is Layla Shakui. And our technical director was Josh Elstro. Archives of our programs are available on our website, WVXU.org. I'm Jay Hanselman, filling in for Dan Hurley. Have a great weekend.